everybody. Welcome back to the PTC podcast. I'm here today with Chloe Evans, Chloe of Wild Tracks and Conservation Chloe. How are you doing, Chloe?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for
Welcome
having me.
Thank you.
Welcome
to our very impressive podcast studio. You like animals.
Of course, I do. Many of them in my house at the moment. Five cats.
How many? You got five cats?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the cats.
I have Gigi. She was my first cat, and she is blind. She had her eyes removed when she was 6 months when I rescued her. And now I'm at five. I need to stop. No more. So I'm not taking any more rescues in. But yeah, I got them over the years I've been in Dubai, which is nearly seven now. And all rescued from the streets, living the best life with me.
How big is your villa or your mansion?
I did have a villa for all of the animals, but now I'm in an apartment, so that's why I can't take any more. But maybe one day I'll have a palace to host many animals in.
And is Gigi the only one that's of special needs?
No, they all are. So Charlie's got one eye. They all have, you know, a whole array of diseases. So that's why they're not very, they weren't easy to be adopted. So they're now living with me.
You like to get involved and rehome cats and little adoption agent.
And dogs and rabbits, anything I find on the street, I'll pick up.
How many do you reckon you have been involved in a rehoming of?
I would say around 30, but I don't want to give credit to myself because there's a lot of very, very good rescuers in the UAE that are doing a lot of this work. So I'll support when I can.
So why 30? Like, people just go, hey, I found a cat and send it to Chloe, she'll find a home?
Yes, I get so many DMs on Instagram, WhatsApp. I'm like the cat guru, especially in my workplaces. Everyone knows that I am obsessed with cats and dogs. So I am the go-to person if there is an animal in need, for sure.
There is a lot of more stray cats, though, here than you might expect. For anybody who's not been in any of the residential areas, there's hundreds of cats in the greens when I'm walking the dog. They seem to be able to proliferate. Is that a kind word?
Reproduce.
And survive.
Yeah.
And they get fed by everybody.
There is a process called TNR, which stands for trap, neuter, return. So this is, we've got like proper cages where you can trap the cats in. Some of them are friendly and some of them are quite feral. And then you send them to the vet, get them neutered, and then you return them back where you found them. And this just helps maintain the overpopulation, let's say.
I think a lot of people must take cats from other places and bring them to the greens.
Yeah,
do their
probably.
Do you feed them? No. Do I feed them?
Yeah.
No, my dog eats their food. I'm actually taking...
Well, you're saving on dog food, so that's
no,
a win.
No, he eats his food too. I don't walk him around the streets in order to save on dog food.
It's an idea, though.
No, people who think it's a great idea to feed the cat and then put the cat food down where the other 100 dogs walk past and just eat.
Sharing is caring.
Better idea would be to any cat feeders, just put it up on a level that the dog can't reach.
Yeah, to be fair, I think that is something that a lot of rescuers are trying to advocate for, is for feeders to put the food in places where it's not as obvious and it doesn't attract other pests, and to clean up after themselves. So this will help the, let's say, the animal and human conflict that might arise from these situations.
Yeah, it's not so much it's just, I don't know what food that is. Mm-hmm. Teddy will eat whatever he eats, my dog. And I will have to pick up after him whenever he goes to the toilet. So the more...
You don't know what's going to come out the other end.
Exactly. The more dog food type matter I have to pick up, the safer, the quicker, the cleaner it is for everything. The more chocolate mousse style I have to pick up, the bigger... I don't pick it up. It just spreads
it's
across...
It's training you to be a dad. For when you have kids, so...
Teddy's 6 years old. I'm fine with that. This is a skill I have nailed down. I think I've looked at him probably over 85... I've watched him go to the toilet over 85% of the times he's been to the toilet. There's probably been a few times when we lived in a villa, he went to the garden, I didn't stand there literally waiting and staring at him. But, so I know what kind of a...
variety he gives you.
And when he eats the cat biscuits, the cat cookies, the cats don't get it.
Yeah.
He gets it. I have one lady tell me, sorry, excuse me, there's cat food just down there. I've just seen her down this path on her hands and knees with paper plates down, feeding the cat. And then she's like, it's okay. it's not wet food. And I had earphones in. I heard everything she said, and I just acted like I didn't hear a word. I just completely ignored her. She was Irish as well, which was the worst bit. But I was like, I'm not talking to you because we're not going to agree on this. Feeding the cats on the pathway.
I know, but they don't have a lot of access to foods.
Are you sure?
Maybe in the Greens it's different.
Are you sure?
You have a lot of communities.
A lot, exactly. The main word is they have a lot. They're the best fed cats in the world.
Maybe I'll send mine there.
Look, everybody seems like they should send their cats there because there's so much food that the cats don't eat all the food. There's just food left lying around and the dog comes by and gobbles it up.
Yeah, maybe I won't. Now there's Teddy on the prowl.
It's good. There's loads of cat carers. They walk around with their little green shopping bags.
Yeah.
They get down their hands and knees. I'm all for saving the cats, but there's a big lake there that often has fish bones around and the fish didn't jump out of the lake.
I'm glad they still have their hunting abilities. But there are a lot of areas in Dubai where the cats perhaps don't have as good access. So I don't want to ever dampen anyone's spirit in helping out animals on the streets.
Yeah, I will only speak for the cats in the Greens. Although I do know that Dubai Hills has cat gangs. So at one end is like a family of cats and at the other end is another family. And
they're also looked after very well. It's a good area for...
Yeah, it's the lovely rehoming people like you who like to go out and feed wild cats.
Save them all.
Yeah.
It's impossible to save them all, but
there's an endless supply of water in the lake that's just there. There's birds that have bird nests because I often see what are they called? Like chicks or fledglings that didn't quite make it. They're on the ground.
Now food.
Well, they were food and they're the discarded remnants of the food. But anyway, cats are well fed. That's the most important thing that we can all go to bed
happy
we've
on.
Done our bit to
you know, I
world.
Actually avoid going to areas where I know that the cats aren't looked after until payday. Because I know once I've got paid, I'll use my salary for the vet bills.
Where are those areas?
Particularly on the border between Dubai and the Northern Emirates. And
you just
I would say on
those
the outskirts.
Areas sometimes?
I don't know. Maybe I need to go on a cat saving mission.
Yeah. There's enough people doing that. You'll be fine.
There are so many groups online as well that I see. So some of my cats I rescued myself, like when I saw them on the street. And then some of them I've seen like on Facebook posts. And you know, there's some that I look at and I'm like, this cat has to be saved by me. I don't know. I have this weird connection with it. And this is what I had with my last rescue, Pippin. I saw him and I think at 2 a.m. I went out. It was in like the DIP area. In one of the like labor accommodations right on the outskirts. And I sent a pin to my friend. I was like, if you don't hear from me in the morning, come and find me. I'm here rescuing a cat. But now Pippin, he's a prince. He lives in the palace with all my others and living his best life.
So what kind of cat do you feel the need that must come live with you?
Definitely one that has like some kind of special needs.
But you're not seeing it in its best, like...
I know, but that was like that attracts me more to want to help it because I feel like it doesn't have a voice. I feel like it has no means to defend itself. And especially the fluffy ones. So there's like a big debate here about the Arabian Mals who are native and then the other breeds that have been imported. Both are equally as important, but for different reasons. So the fluffy ones, they struggle more to survive here because they're not acclimatized to the weather and the conditions. So they pretty much have zero chance during the summer. So, and they're really lazy. So they're easier to rehome because they just sleep. You know, they're not going to create a huge mess in the apartment or something. But the Arabian Mals are also super gentle, very sweet. They're very loud, very talkative, but they definitely deserve a good home as well. So I advocate for all cats.
And they love the chat.
They love a chat. So if you're lonely, get an Arabian Mal. It will talk back to you.
Get a dog. If you're lonely, get a dog. But yes, also get an Arabian Mal because we love cats.
Yeah.
My old housemates rescued a cat. What's the one where there's females only?
The calico.
Yeah.
The three colors, yeah.
Yeah, the brown, gold, black, and white kind of color.
I think it's like 90% of them are female, yeah.
Right. So we came in one day after... middle of the day, I'd just come back from the airport and I got a photograph from my housemate's girlfriend who'd been leaving of a cat curled up in a ball at the bottom of a tree right outside. So my housemate went out, grabbed it, brought it in, put it in a box, cushion, covered it, put in the AC, and then he went to the pet shop straight away, got the
all the supplies,
all the stuff you need, the powder, the water, the bottle thing. And he basically super dadded it back to life over the next few weeks. She was there as well helping, but he was completely properly nursing it. And it grew up to be this beautiful, fun little kitten. There was another cat in the house at the same time as Teddy, so they all got on. But by the time it got to maybe 4 or 5 months, it started to use its teeth. And it
got confident.
It's the only time. So it became a little terror, basically. But it's the only time that I've realized the cat actually is immune to grabbing it by the neck.
Yeah.
So once I reached in to grab it and I picked it up by its neck and moved it to wherever it needed to go. From then on, every time I came over to it, it would lie on its back and show me its belly. And I thought for a long time it was doing belly rubs. I was like, I can't.
It's a trap. It was just ready for your hand to go in.
It would immediately lie down on its belly, put its paws up and start like meowing or whatever. And I'm like, we're not doing belly rubs. I need to get your back. I need to get your thing. And then the times when I would surprise it or grab it, it knew just to go claws out behind its ears and stab your fingers.
This is what I love about cats. They're so sassy. They have their own personalities. I love dogs also.
I never knew a cat could do it. I thought that was like the...
They're clever.
No other cat I've ever touched, been involved with, petted, lifted. I didn't even know their shoulders did that movement. But the cat did it. Figured it out.
You know, I swear to you that people think that Gigi has eyes because she's so clever.
Does she not have eyes?
No, she's blind. She had them removed.
Right.
But people think she has eyes, even though they've literally been taken out and her eyelids, you know, sewn up, because she knows where you are. She will attack you if she wants to. She gets up on the worktop in the kitchen. When I was in the villa, I was so worried about her climbing the stairs. Literally first day, she did like a mapping of the villa. So she went around all of the walls and they use their whiskers to detect where their environment. So she went round, mapped the villa, and absolutely fine. If I move something, there are sometimes...
Moments.
So quite often when I was in the villa, I was like rearranging the garden when my plants were dying because I hadn't watered them. I should be advocating for all things nature, so I shouldn't say that. But I would move some plant pots and there might have been some collisions. But it's fine. She's living to tell the tale. So,
did you ever put your cat's legs in a Smarties box?
No.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. It's not funny. It's not hilarious. And don't put them on the stairs.
Like this is no. This is mean. My cats live their life of luxury. They're never gonna.
You're correct.
I would go without food and have them eat. That's how serious I am.
Take them to the greens. You can buy your own food. There's enough food there. All right, so that's the little cats in Dubai that you're a big fan of.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with the cats in South Africa? Do you want to tell people a little bit about what you do?
Definitely.
And so why we're really here to tell people about?
Yes. So I've always been kind of animal obsessed since I've been little. I was that kid, you know, at school with the encyclopedia of all of the animals, watching David Attenborough to go to sleep to. And then I got the opportunity last year to go to South Africa and I met up with one of the wildlife veterinarians there. And I was just engrossed by everything that was going on. The conservation projects, the wildlife missions, the just being in the bush, being surrounded by nature, the escapism of Africa. And on the plane journey back from South Africa to Dubai, I literally wrote my business plan of how I could connect my world in Dubai to help contribute to conservation efforts, which is why I founded Wild Tracks.
So what's your world in Dubai?
What are you
trying to escape from?
I'm not trying to escape. I think it's just a difference. And, you know, my life has kind of been this juxtaposition between these two worlds. So I grew up in a very small, like, countryside town. My school was a farm. And then I ended up going to university in London. Then I studied abroad in Australia and I kind of backpacked through Southeast Asia. Then I went back to the UK. I actually went to South Africa for the first time just before I moved to Dubai, so nearly 7 years ago. Then I moved to Dubai and then I've been spending all of my annual leave in Africa. So I'm like a cross between this like high life corporate luxury and then just getting down and dirty, you know, picking up elephant poo or you know, whatever it needs, that I'm kind of there. So my life's always been a bit weird. So here I'm working in an office-based job. I'm doing, you know, topics related to consulting, continuous improvement, technology, innovation. And I'm just obsessed with wildlife in Africa. So I was like, how can I connect the, or use the connections that I have to better aid this ecosystem of funding projects or funding research and development, or allowing expertise to be opened up to this world of conservation.
They have a name in South Africa for people like you, somebody who's half British, half South African.
What is it?
It's called a Soti.
Okay.
But I'll let them, next time you're down there.
I hope it's not an insult.
I'll let them.
Mm. It probably is related to the British.
Everything, no, it's more related to Afrikaans, and everything they say, there's a little bit of a...
A bit of a dig.
Yeah, but it's all friendly.
We deserve it.
Yeah. So. You Brits. So what's the, what does it look like on the ground there when you go there? Like what are you trying to achieve? What did your business plan culminate in? What's the mission statement?
My business plan is so big. This is something that I'm known for. I always want to do everything and anything at once, so I'm having to stage it. My mission is to improve conservation efforts, full stop. That was very short, which is good for me. There are lots of different projects which I am working on, as I mentioned, about, you know, innovation, technology, connections, research. But predominantly what you'll see kind of in the public eye at the moment is the tourism related topic. So taking groups to South Africa, and also we've got some projects in some other African countries, which I'm very excited about, to fund and help out and become aware and educated on the missions that we do to help protect wildlife, and to also support with some humanitarian programs that we've got going on. So basically, they come with me to, at the moment, it's South Africa mainly. We kind of do a, you know, the typical program of safari, and, you know, looking, a lot of people haven't seen the Big Five, so that's like on their bucket list. But it's kind of, let's say the focus is the actual mission that we do. So every single trip will have some kind of wildlife intervention, whether it be a collaring or a relocation or a dehorning. And the group actually gets to take part in this activity. So they go alongside the vet and they get to see the full process. So from going up in the helicopter to darting the animal, to then helping to position the animal in the right place in order to, let's say, run the process. And they get to help out the vet with needlework, microchipping, general health checks, and then the luxury of waking the animal back up and seeing it go back.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've left a little important piece out of this, and that the animal is tranquilized.
It is, yes. That's the darting.
Yeah, so the animal is sleeping. Cause
I would never get insured if it wasn't.
I don't think you'd get any survivors either. You would never come back. But yeah, that's obviously a big part of it. Because... You know, some people know, we went down together last summer to meet the guys down there.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more intense than people, than I'd expected. And it's not from an activity perspective. Like, it's not that it's more intense physically. It's that there's a lot more people involved in the days, in the events, in the effort, rather, than you'd expect. So... You know, we went down a couple of days before, I think. We just did the typical game drive, saw the animals, met the guys who owned the reserve. We're shown around the different facilities they have. But then on the day, like, there's six or seven, well, maybe not, maybe four or five Jeeps full of people. And everyone's involved. Like, it's not just the vet and the helicopter pilot and, like, the one person who runs the thing. There's so many people involved in it. And it's quite intense that... If the weather's not right, if the helicopter can't get the right angle on the animals, if they can't find the animals, the thing doesn't happen. You got to wait till the next day.
Yeah.
So when we had our elephant collaring, was the first one. So you can cut me off if I get any of this wrong. Elephant collaring is so that they can track the animal.
Yeah.
So it's pretty low tech as well. It's not like it's GPS. This isn't what you'd expect.
They use the telemetry.
Yeah, and telemetry is just radio.
Yeah.
It's not like it's GPS where they have a nice little...
I have plans for this to improve.
No, but I would have thought, right, 2024, I would have thought that that's not expensive and that that's what's, that should be available. Surely you should know exactly what little... Surely you should be able to wake up in the morning, open up a screen, and see where the elephant has been all night and all day and go back and see when it when its heart rate was up, when its heart rate was... But no, it's just a little radio thing. Then the lady who's in charge of the elephant, like monitoring the herd, she's got to drive around.
Yeah.
Literally drive around with this aerial, this like fancy coat hanger out the window.
Strong arms though.
Yeah.
After that.
Yeah, definitely. Because the earphones in one ear, she's listening to beeps, and then the frequency of the beep. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is this? World War II. Like the frequency of the beep. And it's not their fault. I'm saying I can't believe it's that far behind.
There are definitely, I think, companies or organizations that are looking to improve this, but the fact is that it's such an underfunded industry and there's such a lack of awareness and education. You know, there is a huge let's say driving force from the few that are working in this field who are doing amazing work, but this is why I kind of saw a position for me in this industry. Because I do have these connections, you know, and I have kind of the strategic mindset to try and build more awareness around this. So the guys who are doing this incredible work on the ground can get more support and more funding.
No, look, it's nobody theirs fault. One of the questions you kept asking the whole week, like, does the government not help? What about the government?
I'm a problem solver. I'm like, what about this?
An hour later, we'd be talking about something else. But can you not get government funding? And the South Africans were just looking at you, being like, Chloe, stop saying that. The government don't care. The government are a lot of people just lining their own pockets. Like, they're not here to help the way...
There's so many parts that kind of...
Like there is prevent no this from help. Going,
there's corruption. There is, you know, a lack of awareness, a lack of funding, a lack of education. And that's why we're trying to better connect with the communities that live around the reserve. You know, this is their land. And we want to include them in this process of trying to protect the wildlife. The government, I can't comment on. But I hope that in, you know, years to come that there will be change. And I think the more that we advocate for it, the more that we raise awareness, and the more that we bring in other governments, you know, I'm British, I'm living in the UAE, I'm sure that at some point there will be reasons or ties to support saving the planet together, because, you know, that's what we just had COP28 last year. This year is, I believe it's the year of sustainability. So I think that there will be room and opportunities if we kind of all put our heads together and work, you know, as a unit to try and protect the wildlife. And as you mentioned, there is a lot of people involved, particularly on the days. And I think that this is to try and limit the amount of stress for the animal. So we want the process to be as quick as possible because we don't want them to be under the medication for too long.
Yeah.
And all of the work we do is necessary. We never touch an animal or, you know, do an intervention if it's not needed. This is something that, you know, myself and the vets and the teams I work with are very, you know, strict on. And this is also one of the reasons why our elephant collaring was delayed by one day, because safety comes first. You know, the weather conditions weren't great. The elephants were in thick bush, so we couldn't easily dart them. We also don't want to put any of the guests on our trip at risk. You know, if you're doing it in thick bush, you have less visibility on where the rest of the herd is. And also we don't want, you know, stress to be caused to the animal. So what we normally do is plan for these types of scenarios. We say, you know, this is Africa, things happen,
not as
planned yet. So we kind of allow for those days, and we allow for extra helicopter time. And you know, the most important is that the animal is safe and the guests are safe.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things, when you talk about the amount of people that are there, it's good to see that, obviously. It's just something you don't think about, being a person. I've done safaris before. I think I did one of them a long time ago in South Africa. And you just sit in a vehicle, you just drive around, you look at stuff, and great, there's a lion, there's whatever, see you later. But this was like, you know, there's so many people. They've obviously been waiting for a while for this to happen. They've got such a care and investment in the animals that this is really big for them.
Yeah.
Like, it's really big deal. Everyone's there. I assume there's nobody taking a sick day. There's no one taking the day off. There's sons and daughters and families there who run the farm, run the reserves. And, you know, helicopter comes in. The sound of the helicopter, things change pretty quick when the helicopter shows up. You're kind of waiting around for a bit, just being like, oh yeah, we're gonna dart the elephant. Yay, we're gonna.
That adrenaline kicks in when you hear the.
Yeah, you're like, we're gonna look for the rhinos. I've seen a rhino in the zoo, but like, okay, boom, helicopter comes in, the noise kicks off, and you're like, all right, here we are. And then everybody goes into work mode.
Yeah.
And then you're just sitting there, the tourist at the back, going, don't get in the way, don't fuck this up, don't, yay, let's go. And then the Jeep just takes off across the bumpy trail, whatever, the helicopter comes in, then you start to see the rhino on the hill. And it's kind of like, it's literally like seeing monsters, you know, because you're not used to this. As a foreigner, it's like, oh, there they are, look.
I'm never going to get you to advocate for rhinos.
No, I mean like.
No, I know what you
mean.
It's
beast.
Like.
This is a beast. For sure. This is not a, and it's not a rhino in a zoo. It's a rhino running full tilt.
In the wild, yeah.
Yeah, running full tilt. And it's got its little baby there as well. The baby's trying to scurry along behind. There's loads of babies when we were there.
Yeah.
And the helicopter drops down. There's a guy hanging out at the side of it with a rifle.
A dart gun.
Yeah, but I mean, you're looking at this going, it's a man hanging out the side of a small little helicopter with a rifle. He's going to dart.
It's like something you see in a movie, honestly.
Yeah.
The whole atmosphere is, very cinematic.
And then it just kind of takes off, lifts back up again, as you assume he's right. He's fired the dart. And then with the first one we were pursuing, we got out on the little road. We ran through some bush, little overgrowth. We're booting up this hill and everyone's sprinting. Like we're trying to get there. Obviously you don't want the rhino to be out for too long.
Yeah, exactly.
So stuff has to be done quickly and efficiently.
Yeah.
But and then also like if the rhino goes down, like you kind of mentioned, it needs to be in the right position so it doesn't suffocate under its own weight.
Yeah.
So as we're running up the hill, past the rock, past the tree, past the tree, past the rock, through, then there's another rock, and next thing there's a dart in this rock. And I was like, oh shit, that's the fucking rhino. Like, we've just come up across the back of this rhino on this really steep hill in this kind of, what would you call it, bush overgrowth?
Yeah.
And then there's a monster just sleeping.
Yeah.
Just there. It's just on its against a tree. And then the other one's further up. They were seen to be in pairs that day, which was kind of lucky for our logistics. And then, it's asleep. The vet covers their eyes, plugs their ears, reduces the stress. And then we were there to see the dehorning. So the vet does the dehorning aspect of it. Everyone just kind of stands back and watches.
Yeah, I think for the first one, the vet kind of takes you through the process. And I mean, that day we dehorned, I think it was 11 rhinos.
Yeah.
So by the end, it was like everyone hands on. I think it's important to kind of shadow the vet in the first one or two so you can see what you need to do. And as you say, like there's a lot of tourists that come that are like, I don't want to get in the way.
Yeah.
Well,
that's how I was like. But then after that first one, it's like, okay, it's not actually.
You're like, now I have a role. Now I know what I'm doing.
Like, yeah. Well, it's like
get
now,
out the
okay,
way.
I've seen it. I've seen it once. Okay, I know. It's not actually. It's just to make sure. It's almost like once you get and the rhino is settled and it's asleep, then everyone, like the stress is off.
Yeah.
It's just about quickly. And efficiently going through the list, the tags on the babies, whatever. I don't know, do we take blood or do we give it an injection or something?
Yeah, we did some ear notching so you can identify the animal for the rhino. For some of the calves, we took some DNA samples,
right, yeah, there was
some
an injection involved. The little GPS.
We try and do as much as possible when the rhino is down.
GPS on the ear?
Yeah, the satellite tag.
So they had satellite tags, but the elephants didn't. They just got a collar.
It's trial and error as well because they also did an ankle tag for the rhinos. But, you know, it depends on the terrain.
They were kicking it off or whatever.
Yeah, if it's very rocky, they were like rubbing their legs against the side to get it off. So it depends. I mean, all of the technology that is added, it's supposed to be the least invasive, you know, the least disruptive to the rhino's natural, you know, goings on of the day, let's say.
Yeah, because the elephant literally just got a collar. It got this gigantic necklace with a little radio box on the top or the side of it. But then, like you meant, we did 11. Like by the end of it, that last one was also probably the most intense because the baby went down, lay down, and then the mom was about to lie down on top of it.
Yeah.
And then everybody had to sort of get in beside it. I made a video of this. Well, I actually made a video of the start of it. She's there, the baby's behind.
This was the one I think I blindfolded with the vet.
Yeah.
Which was really special, by the way, because the other riders we did, they already had their blindfolds on because we got out the vehicle afterwards. But to actually see, look into the eye of the animal, that really got to me. It was really emotional. But yeah, then the chaos kicked in where the mama was trying to.
Well, yeah, like you said, she was standing there, not out yet.
Yeah.
And it's like she's going to fall, and the baby was right behind her. So everybody then, as the vet covered her eyes or did the ear thing first, then the guys started to get in to push it. And I'm there making a video, and like one guy goes in, two guys, five or six guys go in, and the rhino wasn't moving. So I was like, I put the camera away and had to
get out your gym guns.
It still wasn't moving. It was like we had to push it like a car, where you push, come off it, push, come off it. And this rhino was just standing up on its four legs.
Get the momentum going.
Yeah, and then it eventually just collapsed down, and then you got to reset it on its belly or whatever.
Maybe you should do some gym training, you know, get like instead of the tires that you pull, you should do like.
Okay, would you like to come to the gym, Chloe, and get involved?
That's why I stood out of that part. I allowed all of the gym people that I invited to show off their muscles.
It's very easy to do, Chloe. You know, just come down anytime.
I took over the filming in the background. I only do the nice parts, the stroking, making sure it's okay.
The video footage, the posing. Hey, well, if you want to start that. By all means, we can run a class. You let me know when you're available.
We should do. We should do like a ranger training class at the gym.
How's your bum leg?
Yeah, I was suffering that trip with my my arthritis flare-up. So I have a free card, you know, free pass.
For people not watching, Chloe is not an elderly person with arthritis, unfortunately. It's a separate conversation that we should keep.
It's a stress-induced semi-burnout, but... Hey, I'm saving animals. So
why don't you tell us the story about the time you ran up the hill?
You mean the
story?
The rhinos?
Yeah.
When they
the first one.
Yeah, so I think this added to the adrenaline of the whole mission for that particular rhino that decided it would be a good idea after it was started to run up the hill. And I was thinking, you know, the whole time I could see the hill in the distance and I was like, it's going to go up there. It's going to go up there. So next thing, I mean, I'm already struggling to get out of the game viewer. And everyone just went. And I was like, no, I've got this. So by the time you made it, and as you say, you saw this rock with a dart in it, the rhino had already started to be dehorned by the time I got up there. So, I'm sure you could hear my breathing over the rhino's breathing. It was disastrous. I climbed Kilimanjaro the year before, though.
What Chloe's not telling him is one of the guys, the rangers, turned around to him and was like, look at you, you got a bum leg, because she was moving so slowly back down to the car for the next one.
Yeah, we had three rhinos darted at the same time. And because, as you say, we don't want to keep them under medication for too long. So I'd already started to make my way to the second rhino when the first rhino was still being dealt with, because I was like, there is no way that I'm going to get down back to the game viewer when all the rhinos were then, you know, awake. And I didn't want to be the reason it was under for too long. So, but I'm back. I'm back fit now. I'm back ready to dehorn some more rhinos with my running legs. So,
okay, very well. We'll watch out for that. look, we've done. What else is there down there to do in the world of conservation? I know that there's like an infinite number of actual jobs, but we've got the collaring for tracking, we've got the dehorning for the rhinos and for anyone who doesn't know, you can cut me off again, the horn's made of keratin, so it grows back.
Yeah.
So it's just
so
like
proud.
So it's just like chopping. Well, this is a bit that I didn't know before. I was like, this anyway, it grows back, so every amount of months or years or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's around like 18 months. It will grow back significantly enough that you would need to dehorn it again.
Yeah.
So dehorning isn't the only solution. There are plenty of others. They also do some like tracking pods in the horn. But the idea of dehorning is that if you remove the horn, you remove the trophy, you remove the reason to kill the animal. So the vet normally measures like 2 to 3 centimeters above the base, which is where the nerve endings are. And then they cut off the horn with a chainsaw, but as you say, it's the same, it's keratin, it's the same as our fingernails and our hair. And then around 18 months later, we'll have to repeat the process. So that's kind of the dehorning side. We also do the collarings, as you mentioned. So this is on a wide range of animals, elephants, lions, hyenas, cheetahs, leopards. We're excited to start some pangolin projects. And also we work with canine units. So they're very important because they work alongside the anti-poaching unit. So they are trained to sniff snares. They're also trained to detect if there's poaching around. So again, they can use their nose to sniff. And also they go on the patrols with the anti-poaching unit, so the rangers. And then we also support a lot of community outreach programs. So I think we visited one when we were there with the old ladies in the community that were collecting plastic bags.
Yeah.
And they were creating like hats and bath mats and all of these items from. I've recently discussed a feeding program, which we're going to help out with in Namibia. So that'll be very exciting. And also they have like lifeline clinics. So to support with, you know, vaccinations or medication. So we're kind of doing, I would say, where we're needed. I'm allowing the experts on the ground to direct where the challenges are or the opportunities are. These guys have been doing it for a lot longer than I have. So I always listen to, you know, their advice. And we work together as and when we're needed to try and make it a better place and, you know, try and help prevent these animals from becoming extinct.
Yeah, I mean, look, that is the main thing, isn't it? Like, it's there's almost, from how I learned, there's two aspects of the conservation. There's just keeping the welfare of the animal and the herd strong and the natural habitat strong and the right amount of predator prey. And then there's the anti-poaching conservation, which is a totally different thing, and the stakes on that one are so much more.
Yeah.
And there had been a rhino that had been poached a few months before we got there, or a year, and they were still obviously devastated about that loss when they were telling us about it. So it's
a war zone. It's a war.
It's like a never-ending battle for them. It seemed where there's a couple of potential avenues for ultimate hope, but right now they're just trying to conserve. It's not like they're not calling it like animal growth and animal widespread missions. It's just conserve, like, let's just protect what we have.
It's just literally saving the ones
saving
that are left
there,
I think at a later date we can look at trying to grow the population. We can look at breeding activities, breeding programs, but at the moment it's kind of like a matter of life or death and survival. So I think that's also why so many people wanted to become like involved when we did the intervention, because it's so meaningful for them. You know, they devote their lives to protecting these animals. So to be part of something hands-on and for that to be funded by WildTrax is something that I'm, you know, really proud of being able to help out with, and also to give that opportunity for people here that might never even know of, you know, that rhinos are becoming extinct.
Yeah.
Pangolins, lions, etc. So it's really special.
I don't know anything about pangolins, but also I didn't know a lot about the animals that we were there. But it's very different to a safari. Having done a safari years ago, like, you just go out in the morning, look around, see the animals. That's kind of cool for the first time as a foreigner, I can't remember the name of the place. It was just north of Cape Town. There was a mom and a baby rhino there as well at the time. And so somebody's been there since, and I recognized the name, sent them a message, and they sent me a photograph of the baby rhino that's now like a teenager or an adult, whatever the equivalent is. So that was kind of cool. But to know that you're actually there with the people who run the reserves, but also just the conversations with them where you learn the mechanics of it all.
Yeah, how much work goes into it? It's like a behind the scenes.
Yeah, because the people who run the tourist part of it don't necessarily have too much. The only invested interest they have in the animals
is making sure they're still there for people to see them.
Yeah, just keeping their attractions.
Yeah,
like walking around. They don't. In the ones that we went to, and in the conversations that I was having, it seemed like they just hand over the responsibility of the protection and the feeding and the maintenance to these, like, passionate people who they just ask them, look, you do it, and we'll keep making our money, you know. And then ultimately the main ranger or the main reserve owner is somewhere far, far away, spending all his money somewhere else instead of, like, reinvesting it back into the tech. So there's loads of money available. Like, as in, there's loads of money exchanging hands over these animals.
I'm sure. I mean, I don't want to, again, comment too much on stuff that I don't have huge transparency or visibility on. But, there is definitely money made in the tourism side. And this is also, I see as a good thing, you know, because you're helping the local economy, you're boosting, you know, investment into the country, as long as it's going to the right place. That's the important thing. But, you know, I can't control for other organizations, but I can control the impact that WildTrax has. So that's why, again, I saw an opportunity for me to place myself to better channel money or connections or expertise through. And, you know, I focus on all the way from very small children. We do some programs, you know, where we help out with some of the orphanages, like rhino orphanages. And, you know, we're even having this program where we can create like some paper mache toys with meat inside for the lions that have been rescued and are being rehabilitated to go back into the wild. All the way up to, you know, CEOs, or, you know, general managers, corporate world, schools, universities. I think every single person has a part to play in this mission to protect wildlife. TV production companies, you know, research centers, the commercials, tourism, you know, law, as we mentioned about governments and corruption. So there is a place for help, action. And I think that if I can channel that into the right place, then I can help out.
Yeah. Well, this is why we went down, is because we were looking at the this, like you mentioned at the very beginning, the side of it where we can bring people to like bring tourists down there, bring their money, show them the animals, show them the way of life, show them, you know, what goes on in a part of the world that's, you know, neglected, ignored most of the time, and actually not just sit in the game viewer, but actually go and get your hands on, like, get your hands on the rhino, get your hands on the elephant.
Well, most of the time when you go on holiday, it's like an in and out. You know, you keep the memories, but it's very, let's say, surface level. You know, you visit a country, but then that's kind of it. You know, you've ticked it off your box, you might go back again. But the reason why we want people to actually be part of the missions is it hits their hearts, you know? So then when they go back, they become storytellers of the mission that we're trying to do. They become advocates for the work that we're, you know, we're helping out with. So that's the reason why we're connecting tourism with these wildlife intervention missions. So they come back and they educate their friends, their family, they recommend these programs, and then we have more people talking about it. You know, the more people that know, the less likely it is for there to be an escape route for people to take advantage of, as you say, money coming in. You know, and also to be educated about when they go to certain countries, you know, there are black markets, there are these commodities being sold. So the more people that know, the better. I think that's the reason why, you know, WildTrax exists.
Yeah. Well, that's what hopefully now we can get people, because one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is to tell people about it, share some of our experience down there. Because the whole thing is, it's a way better experience, like an infinitely better than just a safari.
Yeah.
Because, and you don't have to get out of the vehicle, you don't have to go and do anything, you can just watch. There's people there who just watched. You just need to be, you really just need to be able to move. If you do get out of the vehicle, you need to be able to move, because there's a couple of, there's a couple of moments where it's like, right, as quick as we can, everybody, let's get back in the vehicle. And then you see people almost running or sprinting back. One of the little rhinos woke up pretty fast at one point.
Yeah.
And did a little circle before it figured out which way it wanted to go, and everybody was just out of there. But that's about it. Like, there was a guy that day who didn't get out of the vehicle really towards the second half of the day, when this, like, an older guy, he just stayed watching. And even then, you're still right up close to the animals. You're still right there beside whatever's going on. It's if you don't do that, it's a super chill day. You know, you're out in the African weather, you're out in nature. Like, we were driving around that first day when we had to postpone the elephant collaring the first day, and they were all so apologetic. And I was like, listen, I'm having a great time. There's no animals. We're just driving around this overgrowth with this really red, dusty, sandy road ahead of us for like 2 hours. I was like, this is great.
Especially if you come from like a city environment.
Yeah, exactly,
you know,
yeah.
It's nice just to be driven for once rather than driving yourself, and to be just, you know, absorbing the nature, absorbing some, you know, vitamin D from the sunshine. And
It's also a very special type of nature, because I go to the mountains here all the time every week. I'm not starved of, like, I'm not a prisoner in the city.
Yeah.
But there's no substitute for that type of nature where it's like, I don't know what the right word is, but it's like ancient. You know, it's untouched. It's been there forever.
Yeah.
That sunrise has been coming up and going down.
It's really
over
grounding.
There.
It just like
for a billion years.
And it makes you feel like so small in this world, and also like all of your problems so insignificant.
Yeah.
That's another thing when we do a lot of the community programs. You know, we go into the schools, we go into the villages, and it's so grounding, and you realize that actually the stuff that you're worrying about all the time. Yeah. Does it matter at the end of the day, you know? And I think it resets your mindset, it resets your goals, and you come back refreshed. You come back thinking about, you know, what's really important to me in life. And that's why, I mean, it happened to me. That's why I've started my own business now. And it's a really special place, and that's why I keep going back.
Yeah. Well, look, this is, hopefully we can help in some part to that. We've got a couple of trips. There's a trip in August again. And I'm sure you could arrange any number of trips for anybody listening. But
yes, definitely.
This is one thing I wanted to get talking about, it so that we can send this link out to people who are interested. Listen, have a listen to this. So if you have stayed listening this far, Chloe, how can people get in touch with you?
So the trip is going to be the 11th till the 17th of August, and it's going to be in South Africa. So they can reach out to me on my Conservation Chloe Instagram or the Wild Tracks Instagram, and also I'll share my email address and my phone number for when we post this. And yep, just drop me a DM, send me a message, it can be very casual. I'll send you all of the information, the booking links. And yeah, you just have to sign up. You don't need any experience.
Yeah.
We'll take you through this step by step. Just be willing to contribute.
Yeah.
Or willing to sit on the back of the game viewer and watch the scene unfold. And
yeah,
the more the better.
Yeah, and you can get in touch with us on any of our stuff as well, and I'll send you the info, send you over to Chloe. And then if you can't make those dates, there's other opportunities all over the place down there.
Definitely.
Custom trips, or just reach into your pocket and send your money. No one will say no.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, anything else you want to add? Or
I think that's it. I mean, I can talk for hours about this, but I think that we've summarized what we, you know, what the main topics are. And if anyone does have questions or wants to see some of the work we do, I'm always posting reels and things on Instagram. So just check it out. Give me a follow, like, share, and obviously, you know, speak to people about it. The more people are involved, the better for the animals.
And you can't get these trips online. They're not advertised to protect the animals. You got to know the right people, which is Chloe.
Yeah.
So in this part of the world, get in touch with Chloe. Any part of the world, you can fly from anywhere. We'll meet you at the airport and take care of you from the moment you land. So yeah, cool. Well,
thank you so much for having me.
No worries.
It's a pleasure to speak with you.
No worries. Thanks for the invite as well in June. And anybody down in South Africa listening, hopefully I'll get back down there one day to meet you guys again. And say hello to the animals.
Cool. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Bye.